You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Spring? Is that you? Warmer temps mean new Allbirds styles. Meet the Superlight Collection, the lightest ever shoes from Allbirds, now in fresh colors. They've designed must-have travel styles for when you need to jet. The lighter-than-air feel and barely-there fit makes these shoes some of the most packable styles ever. That means more comfort and less baggage. Take the Superlight Tree Runner on your next adventure. Its cushy, lightweight foam midsole supports every step, and the extra outsole traction gives you the grip to just go for it. The eucalyptus fiber upper adds next-level breathability to keep you going all day. Plus, the Superlight Tree Runner is comfortable and ready to go right out of the box. So, what can you do in a Superlight shoe? What can't you do is the better question. And because they're super packable, the real question is, where are you taking them? Experience how Allbirds redefines comfort. Visit Allbirds.com and use code SUPER24 for a free pair of socks with a purchase of $48 or more. That's Allbirds.com, code SUPER24.
Today's episode is brought to you by our supporters on Patreon, including our Commodore class. That's Commodores Craig, Kinway, Hefei, Jennings, Drunken Dak, Two Gun Tony, The Pirate Nopales, Matthew the Navigator, Bull, Vertigon, Rumgut, and Bootstraps Bailey. And of course our quartermasters, Samuel and Adam. Hello. Welcome to the Pirate History Podcast. My name is Matt. Thank you for listening. When we left off last time, the English privateers in the Atlantic were busy repairing their prize, the Madre de Dios. They were getting her ready as quickly as possible. By morning they had her seaworthy, which was none too soon. As the sun rose, they saw a flotilla of Spanish warships headed in their direction. Had Madre de Dios been on her own, they would have been caught almost immediately. However, they were lucky enough to have 6 privateer vessels serving as escort. Those were lighter and faster than the Spanish ships, and whenever one of the Spanish vessels got too close, an English ship could fall back and engage and give the Carrick time to pull ahead and then reconnoiter with her. As they left Spanish waters and entered English waters, the Spanish ships fell back. They were at war with England, and it would be too dangerous to continue the pursuit, so Madre de Dios made it safely back to England. Richard Hakluyt tells of her arrival in Dartmouth and gives a full accounting of the sheer size of this ship. And then he writes, quote, "This perfect commensuration of the parts appeareth the hugeness of the whole, far beyond the mold of the biggest shipping used among us," end quote. This was the largest ship ever seen in England. She dwarfed every other ship in Dartmouth Harbor. Her masts stood well above the houses on the shoreline. A ship like that was going to draw attention. Once word got out that a ship had arrived that was so impressive people came to see, and once word got out just what was on board that ship, people began to make their way on board. They explored the vessel, and before long they were swarming the deck of Madre de Dios. They began to carry away goods and riches in amazing quantities. It started slow, but it became a torrent of people. They ransacked the ship for maybe an hour before the crew was able to get the situation under control, but even then, they weren't able to stem the tide entirely. Over the following weeks, despite a heavy guard on board, plunder just kept slipping away. People of ill repute arrived in Dartmouth from all across southern England. They arrived to steal and buy and sell whatever cargo was available there. Sir Walter Raleigh was dispatched from London on the Queen's orders to restore order and to oversee the safe shipment of the cargo. They weren't going to sail the Madre de Dios through the channel. Now that it was at an English port, they were going to carry the treasure overland to ensure that nobody could recapture their prize. The Queen, who had heard many varying reports of exactly what to expect, didn't believe her eyes at first. She was elated with the prize and the plunder that came from the capture of that ship. At the time, in 1592, that was fully half of England's treasury. That same report stated, as a conclusion, quote, God's great favor towards our nation, who, by putting this purchase into our hands, hath manifestly discovered those secret trades and Indian riches which hitherto lay strangely hidden and cunningly concealed from us. End quote. The English discovery of exactly what the Indies had to offer would change the shape of English foreign policy, indeed European foreign policy, forever. This is episode 127, Secret Trades and Indian Riches. So what exactly was the cargo? What were these Indian riches that could change and so profoundly shape the history of England? That same report by Mr. Robert Adams gives a full accounting. He writes, quote, to give you a taste, as it were, of the commodities, it shall suffice to deliver you the catalogue taken the 15th of September, 1592, where, upon good view, it was found that the principal wares, after the jewels, which were no doubt of great value, consisted of spices, drugs, silks, calicoes, quilts, carpets, and colors. End quote. Mr. Adams talks at great length about what they found on board. The spices like pepper, cloves, nutmeg, cinnamon, the drugs like frankincense and aloe, the fabrics he goes into some length about, the many different types of calico and silk to be found on board, the pearls, the ambergris, which was highly valuable. He talks about the less valuable but greater in number goods, the porcelain china, the coconuts, the ebony wood. In the end, he writes of this plunder, quote, being divided among the adventurers, whereof Her Majesty was chief, was sufficient to yield contentment to all parties. End quote. And as we will see, that certainly wasn't the case. Many parties were anything but content in the end. As far as the spices were concerned, in terms of quantity, the ship carried 425 tons of pepper, 45 tons of cloves, 35 of cinnamon, 3 of mace, and 3 of nutmeg. Now that's a singularly rich haul, but why did that influence the world so much? Well, first of all, let me address the very real possibility that I, and many of the historians I'm working from, may be placing too much emphasis on the capture of that one ship. If you look at it from a trends and forces approach to historical study, it's pretty clear that everything that was about to come was going to happen anyway. But in this case, this one instance, I think it's appropriate to look at things from the great man approach to historical study, or in this case, the great woman approach. See, Queen Elizabeth is the linchpin to this entire story. She had to sign off on any major business ventures undertaken by any of her subjects, and she was very often reluctant to do so unless you had very good evidence that your business venture was a good idea. For example, if you, say, wanted to found a trade corporation that was going to operate in the East Indies, well, she needed good evidence there. I mean, the East Indies were obviously a rich market, but they were dangerous, they were expensive, and they were potentially destructive to the war effort. Elizabeth was not going to be easily swayed in that decision. But there was one party in particular, I should say at least one party in particular, that was interested in starting that trade. They wanted to open up the East Indies market. The family of the Hawkins. Remember that at least one of them, William Hawkins, had been to the East Indies with Francis Drake on the circumnavigation. What they needed, were they to convince Elizabeth, was real evidence that the East Indies would be a valuable enough market to invest that kind of capital. Now, of course, that evidence was freely available in the East Indies, but they had to get it closer to home. Now, I imagine that the Hawkins family had a network of spies and informants in Spain. I'd be frankly surprised to hear if they didn't. And one of those spies may just have slipped a juicy tidbit to the Hawkins concerning Madre de Dios. That's rampant speculation, I have no evidence at all of that, but that tidbit would certainly have been sufficient to convince someone like Lord Clifford to join into the venture. It would have been enough to convince Lord Clifford to petition the Queen for the release of Sir Walter Raleigh. And it wasn't the plunder that gripped them. I mean, that was certainly a draw. It would have interested the Hawkins and certainly regular privateer captains, but it wouldn't have been enough for men like Clifford. No, he was far more interested in the potential that that plunder could offer. The potential for secret trades and Indian riches. Riches unlike anything that England had ever seen before. Enough that maybe they could sway the Queen. Of course, attempting to sway the Queen in any fashion was a long and detailed process. They needed not only the evidence of the potential riches to be made, but also a solid business plan. They needed ships as well, and men to sail them, and an outline of where they intended to call. And, at least on that last account, Madre de Dios helped immensely. They had the ship's records and maps, which allowed them to make such a plan. But all of that took time. It was an effort of years. And Lord Clifford set about working on it immediately. He shopped the idea around to all of the influential friends he had there in London. He brought men and money into the fold, but even more importantly, there at first, he began constructing new ships. 3 years after the capture of Madre de Dios in 1595, his newest flagship was launched. And that ship has what just might be my favorite ship name of all time. You know, pirate ship names are usually cool. You've got Queen Anne's Revenge and many other ships with some variation of revenge in the name, and I like that. It's an advertisement of intent in some fashion. But a bunch of ship names are less cool. You've got the Fancy, you've got the Royal Fortune, you've got, more recently, the Dainty. Not exactly striking fear into the hearts of men, is it? But Lord Clifford commissioned a 900-ton, 38-gun... Well, it wasn't a galleon, exactly. It had many of the same capabilities as a Spanish galleon, though. It was certainly the largest ship that had been built in Britain since Elizabeth's father, Henry VIII, built his Henri Grace à Dieu. And Queen Elizabeth herself took the liberty of naming that vessel. She called it Scourge of Malice. Scourge of Malice kind of has a double meaning, doesn't it? It could be a malicious scourge that was used against England's enemies, or it could be a scourge to be used against malice, to bring peace between long enemies. Now, Scourge of Malice was originally intended to be a West Indian vessel. It was meant to sail to the Americas and aid Sir Francis Drake in his campaign against the Spanish. However, Cumberland, who was set to captain the Scourge of Malice, had three false starts. Once he was recalled almost immediately after leaving England by the Queen, and twice there was a bout of bad weather that forced him to return to England for repairs. That proved to be disastrous for Sir Francis Drake. Had Cumberland managed to make it to America, perhaps Drake wouldn't have been fatally wounded in a battle at San Juan. However, Cumberland, acknowledging the sacrifice made by Sir Francis Drake, renamed Scourge of Malice. He named the most powerful ship in the English Navy Red Dragon. Now, while all this was going on, while Cumberland was building ships and courting people to invest, there was some drama concerning Madre de Dios, in particular the accounting of the treasure on board. The question stems around whether or not any actual plunder took place, and if so, exactly how much was stolen. That's a matter of debate, a question that we'll likely never know the answer to, but it led to a fair amount of contention about the shares that the captains received. Lord Cumberland and Sir John Borough, the admiral of the fleet that captured Madre de Dios, both lodged official complaints about their shares. They were careful not to implicate the Queen in any fashion, Instead, they pointed the finger at Sir Walter Raleigh. They alleged that the report, which was overseen by Raleigh, made false conclusions about the total of the treasure and how much may or may not have been stolen. They alleged that, possibly, Raleigh was skimming off the top to enrich himself while shortchanging his comrades. It's not impossible that they were correct in this assumption. Sir Walter Raleigh wasn't exactly well known for his scruples. It's not outside the realm of possibility that he did shortchange his comrades. Whether or not he did, though, doesn't really matter, because that is what Clifford and Burrow believed. Now, Lord Clifford, the Queen's champion, received a balm from Elizabeth. She allotted him a sum of money in thanks for his good works in capturing Madre de Dios, and she aided him financially in the construction of Red Dragon. John Burrow, on the other hand, the admiral, remember, received nothing. He decried Raleigh loudly and publicly, and he did so often. At one such occasion, almost 2 years after returning to England on 7th March 1594, Sir John insulted Walter Raleigh in front of John Gilbert, who just so happened to be a cousin of Raleigh's, and Gilbert challenged Burrow to a duel. Burrow accepted and chose rapiers as the weapon of choice, and arrived at the fight ready to kill the cousin of the man who he believed had stolen his fortune. However, he lost that duel. Sir John Burrow was killed on the 7th of March 1594, and the question of his compensation was no longer an issue. Despite leading the armada that captured Madre de Dios, John Burrow has been largely forgotten to history. The other names in this story, though, Walter Raleigh, Christopher Newport, James Lancaster, George Clifford, they are all famous Elizabethan adventurers. But Burrow, well, Burrow died too early for any of that.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for the New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
Madre de Dios would open up doors for the wealthy and well-connected in English society, and had Burrow accepted his paltry sum and walked through that door, perhaps we would remember him today, but he chose a different path. But it wasn't just the landed aristocrats that those doors opened up for. Similar doors were opened for the less fortunate but highly talented sailors and soldiers, and especially the merchants. It was merchants more than anyone else that George Clifford courted. He approached a number of rich and powerful men in and around London, anyone who had an interest in the spice trade, and, of course, who had the money, was approached and offered this investment opportunity. Historian John Key writes in his wonderful book, The Honorable Company, A History of the English East India Company, quote, "The company's stock appealed to two very different types of investor. On the one hand, there was the shareholder primarily interested in a quick and substantial return on his investment. He might be anything from a tradesman to a courtier, but he had no obvious interests in the specifics of its trade. On the other hand, there were those who perceived some collateral advantage in the trade itself. The group consisted of wealthy and influential city merchants with extensive financial interests outside the company. These two types of investor may roughly be identified with the company's two institutional bodies, the General Court and the Court of Committees. End quote. These two bodies worked a lot like modern companies do today. The General Court was a body of shareholders who, well, at first they were just investors, but later on they would meet maybe once every quarter or so to vote on big picture company business and to hear updates on their stock in the company. The Court of Committees was a much smaller body of those employed in the day-to-day running of the company. When Mr. Key, the author of that history, mentions financial interests outside the company, he's talking about, well, a bunch of different financial ventures, but the most prominent among them was the Levant Company. The Levant Company was a trading corporation that was vested with the power to trade with the Levant, which means the Ottoman Empire. They played a major role in the relatively positive relations between England and the Ottoman Empire, Elizabeth and Suleiman the Magnificent. The Levant Company came in second only to the Venetians when it came to trading with the Ottomans for goods traveling overland through the Mediterranean. However, those merchants who were interested primarily in spices and silk now found an opportunity to cut out the Ottoman middleman. They could cut out the overland trade routes and even undercut the Portuguese. There were quite a few people who found that very appealing, but three London merchants more than any other showed serious interest in Lord Clifford's plan to form a trading company with the Far East. You may remember James Lancaster as the commander of a failed 1592 voyage to the East Indies. But James Lancaster did gain personal knowledge of the sea routes and the sultans with which any such venture would be concerned. Lancaster, who was perhaps first into this fold, brought in his two most prominent financial backers from the Levant Company, Thomas Smith and John Watts. When I talk about rich and powerful merchants, this is who I'm talking about. And the word merchant has kind of a quaint connotation. You might picture people peddling sausage rolls on the corner, or perhaps when you think rich and successful merchants, you think a clockmaker who makes very fine clocks sold in the highest courts in Europe. But no, that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about Jeff Bezos. We're talking about captains of industry. Now, Thomas Smith and John Watts weren't landed gentry. They were commoners, for now at least, but they were both financial and political movers. They were middle class in England at the time, but they would be very much considered upper class today. They were middle class in that they didn't have the dignity or the gravitas of the aristocracy, but they held just as much, if not even more, real power than most landed gentry. Some families of a certain quality, the Roosevelts, for example, wouldn't ever think about muddying their hands with merchant or political affairs, but of course, once one particular Roosevelt named Theodore decided to break that rule, he became one of the most famous, beloved, and powerful world leaders of all time. So these four men, Lord Clifford, Thomas Smith, John Watts and James Lancaster combined their efforts to bring in all the financial and naval players that were active in England at the time. This small group, along with a cadre of more than 200 other movers and shakers, prepared a proposal. They were going to take it before the Queen in early September 1599. They argued the merits of their plan well. They pointed out that it served not only financial purposes, but military purposes as well. You know, they're at war with Spain, which of course puts them at war with Portugal, and breaking that monopoly, the Iberian monopoly on the spice trade, would be an unbelievable move, militarily speaking. But as the bard, William Shakespeare, an active playwright at the time, would have said, here's the rub. England's closest ally in all the world, and certainly in their fight against the Spanish, the Netherlands, well, they were already in the East Indies. And that should break down nicely. You know, if the Dutch take Asia away from King Philip and profit from that trade, England would have the opportunity to hack away at Spanish America and profit from those lands. It's a two-front worldwide campaign that would break up Spanish dominion all over the world. It would enrich the Protestant allies of England and the Netherlands. It's a win-win, and nobody would have to get territorial here. It seems perfect. So those petitioners in September of 1599 were turned away. Elizabeth didn't want to destroy that perfect system, and beyond that there was the question of peace talks with Spain. They were ongoing, and Elizabeth didn't want to endanger those talks by entering into the spice trade. But it actually might have been the Dutch who swayed Elizabeth here, who changed her mind on this decision. The American campaign was, well, the privateers were bringing in money, but they had as yet to really solidify any big money-making ventures over there. There were no major colonies, for example. And the Dutch were, well, they were getting rich. They were bringing in huge hauls of Asian spices, so much so, in fact, that they didn't have enough ships to carry it all. To pick up the slack, they attempted to hire English ships for their ventures. And they offered decent rates, too, at first, £3,000, and then, when the English demurred, they offered more like £5,000. And that's not bad for a ship that would be fully insured if she were lost and was not involved in any other venture at the time. But the cargo, well, the cargo that they would have on board would be worth easily 10 times that amount. And it appeared that the Dutch were going to make yet a better offer, which only went to solidify the point that they had money to spare. The cadre of merchants who made that initial proposal came back a year later, in December of 1600. They pondered before the Queen, why should our fine ships go to make the Dutch rich beyond their wildest dreams? Should not these English vessels enrich Englishmen? What's more, these merchants had more money and more ships and more men than they had had a year ago. Elizabeth was always a pragmatist. She tended to make the decision that would fill her coffers and the decision that would do the best to appease her most prominent subjects. And this time, she was swayed. Queen Elizabeth granted a royal charter to, quote, George, Earl of Cumberland, and 215 knights, aldermen, and burgesses, end quote. Lord Clifford was, at the time, the only landed man involved in the company, but everyone here was rich. The company's official name at this point was the Governor and Company of Merchants of London trading with the East Indies. The governor in question, the nominal leader of the company, was Thomas Smith, the Sheriff of London. However, he would die in just a few months' time before they even went on their first voyage. The governorship passed on to John Watts. Now, this happened at the very end of 1600, but happening at the turn of the century kind of has a nice, round, poetic symbolism to it. Maybe it could be seen as a sign that the 1600s were going to be a big century, and, I mean, they were. It also means that the English East India Company was the first East India Company. Technically, at least. This company existed before their Dutch equivalent, but it would be restructured and rechartered a few years later, after the VOC, the Verenigd Oost-Indische Compagnie, the United East India Company, the Dutch East India Company, after they were founded. But before all of that drama could take place, the English had to sail for Asia. George Clifford sold the Scourge of Malice, the Red Dragon, to the English company at a very favorable price. And that ship now was officially the first East Indiaman. The East Indiaman was, well, there isn't a particular type of ship called an East Indiaman. Any ship that was used for the East India trade was technically an East Indiaman. Of course, the Portuguese ship was better known as the Carrick, the Spanish vessel was the Galleon, and the Dutch had their own fleet vessel. But this ship, the Red Dragon, served as a template for English and Dutch and French ships that would become the model for what an East Indiaman was for about 200 years. Now, they weren't galleons. The hull was less barrel-shaped than a carrack or a galleon, and they weren't quite a frigate. The holds were larger than a typical frigate to accommodate more cargo. The East Indiaman, much like the Red Dragon, could be manned by a relatively small crew, but they also had plenty of guns on board, guns that could ward off pirates and, later on, interlopers into the East India trade. Now, that might sound kind of like a perfect pirate ship, but it really wasn't. Pirates tended to prefer sloops and frigates, which were sleeker and faster, they could intercept an East Indiaman easily, and they held more guns. But there were occasional East Indiamen that served as pirate ships in a pinch. They were the perfect ship for sailing into uncharted, potentially dangerous waters. And that was exactly where they were headed. Their enemies were many. There were the obvious enemies, the Spanish and Portuguese with whom they were currently at war, and there were the possible enemies, hostile natives and potentially hostile sultans. There were the invisible enemies that they were not prepared to deal with, scurvy, malaria, dysentery, and cholera. And then there were enemies that they never would have expected. Enemies that would have been in the last place these Englishmen would ever have looked. Enemies who, when they arrived, were their closest friends in the entire world. The greatest enemy that the English would face in the East Indies would, after all, be their close allies, the Dutch. Next time, we're going to follow Red Dragon and James Lancaster into Southeast Asia. We're going to look at the budding enmity between the Dutch and English, these old, old friends. We're going to follow that relationship as it develops, from forced friendliness into open hostility and finally, open warfare between nation-states. We're going to look at the relationship as it evolved between the reigns of Queen Elizabeth and the Glorious Revolution, which will catch us up, as far as the East India Companies are concerned, to our story in the Philippines concerning the Signet and Charles Swan and William Dampier. At the moment, they are enjoying themselves in the Philippines on the fringes of company power, but that crew is about to run headlong into both the Dutch and English East India Companies. I'd like to thank everyone for listening. I'd like to thank everyone who has helped to support the show. Everybody who has signed up to become a patron on Patreon, everybody who has left us a review or a rating wherever it is you listen to the show, and everyone who has recommended this show to your friends and family. Without all of you, I wouldn't be able to do this. Thank you. Our theme music was, as always, The Old Captain by the fantastic band Brillig. If you have yet to check them out, you absolutely should do so. You can find them at brillig.com.au. That's brillig.com.au. After you're done over there, why not check out our website at piratehistorypodcast.com, or you can get in touch on Twitter, SoundCloud, Reddit, or YouTube. As always, and most importantly, thank you for listening.
Live on in legend tonight.